Welcome to episode 2 of the Plugged In podcast by Sweetwater. I'm your host, Mitch Gallagher. Thanks so much for joining us today. This time out, we'll be sitting down for a chat with guitarist extraordinaire Andy Timmons. Andy first came to international prominence with the 80s band Danger Danger, and he's gone on to build a thriving career that includes playing with fusion drummer Simon Phillips, many years as Olivia Newton-John's guitarist and music director, and tons of session work. But he's perhaps best known as a very prolific solo artist. In fact, during this introduction, you're hearing the song Apocryphal from his latest album, Electric Truth, which was produced by another great guitarist, Josh Smith, and released in March of this year. Andy always has a positive attitude, and in this interview, he'll deliver a healthy dose of perspective, insight, encouragement, advice, and inspiration for musicians of all genres and instruments. Thanks so much for joining us for episode 2 of the Plugged In podcast by Sweetwater. Settle in, and let's get started. Andy, great to have you here, man.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be back up in Fort Wayne.
Yeah, back in Indiana.
I'm back, and this is my home state.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, I am a native Hoosier.
Yeah.
Well, I moved here when I was 5. We moved to Evansville, Indiana in 68.
Wow.
And then I was, a Hoosier until, 83 when I went down to school in Miami.
Nice.
So it feels, what I was saying as we were driving in today from the hotel downtown, it, even though we're at the complete opposite ends of the state, Fort Wayne versus Indiana, it still feels very much like home. It's just that this particular part of the country and just the nature of the...
It's got that Midwest vibe,
the architecture and the streets. Yeah, it's a... And there's a Cork and Cleaver here and a Pizza King. So there's two old favorite restaurants from Evansville. It's all about the food, folks.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, man, you got so much going on. It's interesting looking at your resume, if you will, and your history. And actually, I saw something in your bio where you were talking about this, that you always wanted to be able to support yourself as a musician and not have to necessarily just have one thing that you completely depended on to do that.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot of stuff. You got a new album.
Yeah.
You're here doing a masterclass. You're here doing a recording workshop. You're out with other players. You're doing sessions.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, it's funny. It's interesting that you say that, and that I could see where that would be the perception, but I never had a specific, defined goal. I just knew I wanted to play guitar and try to do it at the highest level that I could. And there was always that drive to practice and get better. And the career just kind of happened based on that, mm-hmm. By nature that I was so fond of anything with guitar in it. I started off as a rock player, like so many of us, I think, it was in 70s rock and roll. It was all, Kiss and Rush and Foghat, But as the ears grew and I started taking lessons eventually and got into jazzier stuff or blues or country, it just by taking as much of that in it gave me the opportunity to be diverse. And when I got an offer to do a gig, whatever it might be, I could usually say yes,
Yeah.
And so as we know, no matter what level you're on, it's not the easiest thing to make it, purely as a musician. So diversity was really, really a thing that, helped me, especially early on, but still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
When you brought up Olivia Newton-John earlier, and the same time that I was touring with her, I would be doing tours with Simon Phillips.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to think of two more, contrapuntal bookend musical things, but I enjoyed them just as much. Sincerely, they were both challenging on a very high level in its own way.
Right.
And that's kind of up to you, the level that, the bar that you set for yourself, do you take it lightly? It's like some people might not consider Olivia's thing a difficult gig, but I guarantee you there's not many that I think could traverse the wide swath of her sonic and the variety of material that she did all the way from country to jazzy stuff to rock, So I treat every gig like it's the most important gig I'm ever going to do. If it's a cover gig that weekend with some friends or whatever, I want to come in as prepared and do the best I can. And I think overall that leads to a reputation where people know, okay, well, this guy can do the gig.
Yeah,
hopefully that's the idea.
Yeah, right.
So, but yeah.
Yeah. That, of course, we were so sorry to hear that she had passed recently.
Yeah.
A loss and condolences to you on that, because I know you were very good friends.
We were friends and close friends. It was about 15 years of working together. Yeah. We started together in 1999. I came in actually as a sub. She had retired. She had breast cancer in the early 90s and basically retired at that point. When she'd gotten through it, she was in the clear after a while and decided she's just going to stay home and take care of her daughter. And in the late 90s, she started doing a couple of shows in Australia. And her band at the time, there's a huge singing star named John Farrar. I'm not John Farrar, but John Farnham, sorry. John Farrar is the guy that wrote a lot of Olivia's material. But John Farnham, kind of a rock and roll. He's like the Springsteen of Australia, huge, huge star. He was in the Little River Band at one point. And so it was his band that was backing up Olivia, and they wanted to come to the U.S. to do some shows. And one of the guitar players, Brett Garzid, couldn't make the tour. And Olivia's management was Fitzgerald Hartley, which was the same management as Toto. And, of course, Simon Phillips, who I was working with, was a member of Toto at the time. So I get a call from Simon Phillips one day. Andy, you fancy working with Olivia Newton-John? I'm like, yeah, what are the hours, Paging Nigel. Right. Or, yeah, David St. Hubbins.
Right.
Yeah, so... It just, and so I, went into it, like we were just talking about, I'm going to go in and I'm going to have my stuff together. And the first rehearsal in Vegas went just flawless. And, so the tour went great and management and she recognized, well, Andy's got his act together. Let's put together a U.S.-based group and put Andy in charge of that. And so I became her music director as well as a guitar player. And that was, 15 years of a lot of fun together. It was never... With Olivia, it was never like star and band, Of course, you're on stage and you are kind of with this iconic legend of a, right. Not just her singing career, but the Grease movie. And people just love her. And you understand when you're around her because so many people that, have come to me to say, we're sorry about Olivia and we know we were close. And they would always say, we kind of felt like we knew her. And you kind of did because that was her. What you saw was real. It was, there was no facade with her. It was, there was not like separation of star and band. We hung together all the time. We'd go to movies and, karaoke and, comedy clubs and just had a great time. And man, she was a deep, deep well of musical knowledge and tune. She knew every jazz standard, every Beatles tune, every sound check, we'd be just go off in any direction and she'd just hung, And so it's just, and so many great stories because she was in swinging London, There was one of my favorite stories that I just salivate over is that, she was tight with one of her early boyfriends was in the Shadows, Cliff Richard's backing band. Of course, Hank Marvin was the great guitar player for the Shadows. And I forget whether it was Bruce Welch or Brian Bennett, but anyway, the Shadows were, peers, and actually the Beatles revered the Shadows. Yeah. There's that song Cry for a Shadow, the only John Lennon George Harrison composition that they recorded in Hamburg at the Tony Sheridan sessions was a tribute to Hank Marvin and the Shadow. Pretty cool. But anyway, so she was the one night hanging out with Paul and the guys at Paul's Cavendish Avenue flat, and he was working on this piano piece, and it turned out it was Lady Madonna.
Wow.
So she's got stories like that. That's so anytime she'd pull out some of that stuff, I was always just hanging on every word.
That's
fascinating. She was only 73 and so sad, but she did so much for cancer awareness. I'm not sure if you're aware, she has the Olivia Newton-John Cancer, Treatment and Wellness Center in Australia. And she saved my life. I had cancer. This is actually maybe one of the first times I've talked about it publicly, but I had cancer in 2013, and it was one of those things where I could tell something was wrong. I was having some pain in a particular area of my body, and I could tell, look in my eyes in the mirror. But when she told her story about how she got through that time, or when she first was detected, she could just tell her body was telling her something was wrong. And she went to a doctor and said, oh, we didn't find anything. You're fine. She went to another doctor. No, you're fine. Third doctor said, thank God you came in. We found something and you need to come in for surgery. And so she would always tell me the story, if you ever think anything's wrong, go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could tell something was wrong, and I looked in the mirror, and most guys go, I'm fine. I got this, right?
That's what we do, right?
So I went to the doctor on a Monday, my general practitioner. I said, look, I'm having some pain and this issue. And he goes, I think you're fine, but let's do a sonogram. He calls me the next day. Well, I'm really surprised, but there is something here, and you need to see a urologist, ASAP. So I get to a urologist the next day on a Wednesday. that urologist looked at my scans and said, we're not even doing a biopsy. You're coming in tomorrow for surgery. Wow. So from a Monday to a Thursday. And once they had done the procedure, you know, said, look, if you hadn't come in, you know, this is the most, you know, aggressive form of cancer. It could have been a very different outcome.
Wow.
So I literally can say that she saved my life. And aside from just adoring her, loving her, like if you met her, you felt like you knew her, you know.
Yeah.
But to spend that much time together, yeah, and to call her a friend, it's a loss. But I'm just, you know, there's so many people that knew her and loved her. But even the folks that just were just admirers from afar, it's a loss, man. So
sure
is. Anyway, yeah.
Rest
easy.
Yeah.
Loved
yeah,
one.
Definitely.
Yeah, man.
So that's looking at your job as the music director there and
yeah.
as a guitarist, as you said, you know, it seems like that'd be an easy gig. These aren't complex virtuoso jobs, but any gig, if you want to do it at a high level, requires preparation,
right.
It requires ability, it requires being confident, and all those things that you have to put into it so that when you get on the stage,
yeah,
it looks easy.
Yeah, that is the thing. And some of those tunes are actually not virtuoso in the dexterous sense, but virtuoso in the feel and application. And like you say, just delivering it in the right way. And that and very fortunately, you know, the band that eventually, you know, there was some members that would come and go, but largely the same group of people stayed with her for that many years. And we all treated the gig the same way, with the reverence for the material and the love for her. And it wasn't about like, hey, I'm Andy Timmons, I'm going to let's see what I can do. Let me, you know. No, it's like as the band leader, I just wanted, I put myself in the position of the fan coming to see her, that they may only see her once in their lives, and they want to hear those tunes the way they want to hear them, not what everybody can flash and do, but to really present it in the right way. And I quite beautifully, her main songwriter, John Fair, is an amazing guitar player. And in fact, he was in a band with Hank Marvin called The Strangers.
Wow.
So he and Hank Marvin were tied back in the late 60s, early 70s. So he has quite a pedigree in his own right. But he's the guy that wrote Hopelessly Devoted and, yeah, Have You Never Been Mellow? And so many great tunes. Don't Stop Believing, not the Journey one, but, you know, I could go on and on. But yeah, to be able to appropriately present those tunes is not an easy thing. And I, you know, there's a lot of virtuoso quote unquote players that couldn't get close to it.
Right.
I mean, I'm not in a bragging sense, but it takes that reverence and appreciation to what really makes a tune, you know, work a certain way, you know? So mm-hmm. I learned a lot doing it, man. It was fun.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
What a great experience.
Yeah.
So I would, looking at it from the outside, suggest that one of the reasons you were so great for that gig uh-huh. is your focus on melody.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, those are obviously very melodic songs, but yeah. everything that you do has that vocal melody quality to the lead playing and the melodic parts, if you will.
Oh, the composition of them. Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's also the everything from the funky rhythm backgrounds to the heavier guitar things, especially evident on the new album, Electric Truth.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
there's such a diversity of music there, and it does go all the way from almost Earth, Wind, and Fire style, you know, EWF.
Veiled reference. Yeah,
yeah. To heavier things and bluesier things.
Right
and,
on, man.
And the beautiful ballad playing that you do on that album.
Thank you, man.
So all of which to get to. Tell us about that album. Tell us about working with Josh Smith and what he contributed as producer.
Oh, it was great. Such a great thing. So yeah, Josh Smith, I'm sure all the listeners would know. If they don't know, type in Josh Smith on YouTube and be amazed at some of the great guitar playing you'll ever hear. I met Josh, and you know, I remember calling him just to tell him, man, I'm just such a fan, and because I was just seeing all these great videos on YouTube, and his band always sounded great, and I liked his arrangements. So I literally just called just to say hi and to say, man, you just wanted to, you know, chat a little bit. He goes, hey, man, I just finished putting my studio together out in my house in L.A. Come record. And you know, Mitch, over the years, we all get like, yeah, let's get together, man. Yeah, buddy, let's. No, but I could tell in Josh's voice, even after not knowing him that well, you could just tell he's a 100% straight shooter. And I thought, this is the right thing to do. I was like, yeah, man. So this would have been late 2019. And we thought, well, I'm coming out to LA for the NAMM show 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just come out a couple days early. You know, so I started kind of writing tunes, and we even wrote a couple tunes over the phone, you know. Like EWF, I had the main funky, that Al McKay, you know, that kind of. Thank you. I always wanted to do a tune that felt like Shining Star, because that was one of the coolest guitar things ever. And so I remember Josh writing the bridge over the phone, you know. It was just, so basically, but the liberating thing for me was it was going to be something I wasn't going to do it with. It wasn't going to be an Andy Timmons band record. I wanted it to have Josh's stamp on. So I said, Josh, you produce, you pick the band, you know, I'll just come out as the quote unquote artist and let's do the record that way. And he's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So he picked his main stable of guys, Lamar Carter, a great, great drummer, who's now Joe Bonamassa drummer, thanks to Josh. Travis Carlton, who you might know,
on the
bass.
Amazing, yeah.
He's amazing. And Dayron Johnson on the keyboards, who, you know, played with Miles for one name to drop amongst many others. He's got an amazing career. But so they were the band, and we, you know, put some rough charts together. I had some demos that we either did in some in GarageBand, some in Logic, and basically did the record in 2.5 days.
Wow.
So the idea was, you know, we knocked out all the basic tracks live together in the room, and then I was going to come back in March to finish all the overdubs we didn't get done if I wanted to redo a solo. Well, nobody went anywhere in March 2020.
Right.
you guys, did you hear about that pandemic? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So I just over the next year, you know, sporadically would, you know, finish up a track and send it to Josh, and his great mixing. He tracked the sessions and mixed it. A guy named Alan Hertz, who actually happens to be a great drummer himself, but great, great engineer. And that's one of the things I'm most fond of, is just the sound of the record.
Mm-hmm.
The band plays so beautifully. These guys are such, you know, just consummate players. And they for the guitar, yeah, it's we're covering a lot of ground, but the band makes it happen. You know, like that funky track EWF. And that's 100% live. That's, you know, we didn't do one punch. That's us playing together, you know, in the room. And it's got that crazy section at the end that changes time signatures, but it's got a vibe to it. So luckily, if you can capture that, you know, that's a gift, right? So, but then see some of the delicate ballad things, and then some of the heavier rock. So these guys really, you know, are the same in that they can cover all that ground and just really make it feel the way it needs to feel.
Right.
Yeah, Lamar's one of my new favorite drummers, man.
There's a real groove, and, really and Travis great. Is so adept at locking in.
Oh, God, and he's so that beautiful sound. Just a beautiful guy, and Darren, too, man. And so Josh, you know, he was... You know, he's not a heavy-handed producer, at least with me, you know. You know, I'm coming in because I produce most of my own stuff. So once I get in there, things are in a pretty good place. But he had just the right stuff to add, some of the production ideas with like a keyboard idea and some of the arrangement stuff, too. He was brilliant at, like, that riff at the end of EWF. It's like, it was perfect. It's like, that's exactly what the tune needed for this outro jam. And so he was so good with on-the-spot stuff of like, ah, we need this,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, but it was essentially, you know, he would just kind of let me do my thing if he thought it needed a suggestion. And that was another cool thing where it when I'm doing my own records, you know, my bass player, Mike Dane, co-produces a lot of stuff with me, or Rob Wexler over the years, you know, great violinist in his own right. But it was wonderful having an amazing guitar player in the room.
Yeah.
It's a different energy because, you know, not you're always around people that have great ears, but you know when it's a guy that you really respect and love what they do, it's like, yeah, I think you're trying to rise to the occasion, maybe even more. You might be pushing yourself. But just then the input they'll have from Josh's massive experience from having done lots of session stuff for other people. He's got a wide range of knowledge of music, of course. And so I really enjoyed that dynamic. And we had a great time, man. It was so easy. He's a really diligent, hardworking guy, and really, really made that record happen. I was very thankful that it happened.
Yeah. It's really fun to listen to. It clearly is live, and you're having fun. And there's an organic quality when you all play in one room, and all happens as a foundation to build off of. It has to be really freeing for you as a player, then,
yeah,
to be able to sit on top of that, if you will, or ride on top of that.
No, absolutely, and you know, but also it also reminds me of a saying I came up with. Make sure you're practicing all the time so you don't suck on take one. Remember that, kids. We're laughing, but there's been times in my career where maybe I wasn't practicing as much as I should. You know, sometimes career and life takes over and you're getting, you know, you're playing, but Yeah, but once I got back into a thing where that's literally the first thing I do every day is play guitar. Whatever I have to do to, you know, get up a little earlier, arrange my schedule a certain way, that coffee and this guitar, if I start my day and play for like an hour, just even if it's just playing standards with iRealBook or whatever it might be, just to have that connection and try to be learning a little bit every day. And then, yeah, so then you can be lucky and get that first take and go, that didn't suck. That's all right. No, it's, you know, there really is, there's a lot to that. But yeah. So it's handy when you get it. So for me, sometimes it's either the first take or the 97th, depending.
So once you start thinking about it, you know.
Right. You thinking about it sometimes is not the good thing, right? Sometimes
it's the worst not thing. Think about it's it. The worst thing. No, the full disclosure, at the end of that tune EWF, it's in the odd time signature, and it's in the key of E, but I can, when I went back, I do these videos. I have a subscription lesson site called guitarexperience.net, slight plug there, but I learn note for note, you know, my songs through my catalog and present them. I play them on screen and then teach about every part of the song, right? So this one, that because it was completely improvised, I really had to transcribe my own solo. Mm-hmm. When I was doing it, I started realizing I'm playing in B minor the whole dang time over this thing in E, which it does work.
It does work, yeah.
And it melodically sounds fine, but in my mind, I could just, by what I was playing, I could tell I was thinking in the wrong key. it really magically works. I thought, wow. Anyway.
It's a perspective thing, though. It's not the wrong key. You're just doing a really cool substitution.
It is. Well, it does work. That's the minor, the five minor over the one, over the four, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
The two over the five.
So you mentioned that you play jazz standards first thing in the morning as part of your practice. Yeah. Tell us about what you do there. Are you just jamming? Do you have something you're working on when you sit down with those standards?
Yeah. It can work in a lot of ways. A lot of times, I like to not, just before the mind kicks in too much, I love either playing All the Things You Are or Record a May or sometimes Giant Steps and just let the ear and the fingers get in tune, you know, and just play melodically over these changes, right? But then a lot of times there may be, if there's something that I'm working on, a particular arpeggio or an idea, like, a, you know, just trying to get in more diminished ideas over the flat nine on five chords. I can start intellectualizing it, but I prefer just to play first because that's really what I want to be exercising, is the melodic, you know, just the instinct. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned a bit about jazz starting when I was about 16, and then I went to study jazz for 2 years at the University of Miami, and so I can intellectualize all of it, and I got fairly adept at playing straight ahead at a certain point. But then years go by, and if you're not really kind of working on that, that muscle can kind of get flabby. And then, but yeah, within the last maybe 10, 15 years, I really got back into the habit of, because even though, you know, you may not recognize when I'm playing rock and roll, so much jazz influence in there, but it's a huge part of what I do, and it's mainly about the voice leading. You know, where when you're playing through changes like in jazz, just for say the standard 2-5-1 progression, that you can think about that all in one key. But in the study of jazz, you're usually kind of realizing, well, if I voice lead through the thirds and seventh of each chord, then you really hear the chord changes go by, right? So that gets interjected into everything that I do. You know, if it's just A minor to G to F, I know I can play A minor all day, but I really want to make sure those chords are being heard as they're sounding and have the melody reflect that. And when people, you know, talk about my sense of melody and all that, I would say a lot of it comes from that, but a lot of it comes then also through just the love of great melodies. I mean, it's just, sure, want to play more melodically, just learn great melodies. And I just grew up just a complete pop guy with all the Beatles stuff in the 60s. But then now it goes from everything from the standards to classical, and whenever I can find a particular note over a particular chord that makes me feel something, I want to know what that is and get that in there, you know, and have it be part of what I do. So it's really a process of all those things. But yeah, so there, in the jazz standards every morning, because that'll get the melodic ear going, having to navigate, right, you know, exercise, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, again, a differentiating point for your playing, though, in that a lot of players, they'll go outside the key, outside the scale,
yeah,
bring in some unusual notes, but they tend to land on the root, the fifth,
Yeah.
You know, I hear a lot of that, particularly in sure. instrumental rock albums, whereas sure. you're landing on some different notes at the seventh, you know, if you're on the F in A minor, yeah. you hit the, you know, the E instead.
Different
you know,
color tones.
Yeah, yeah. So those color tones.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is those arrival points to my
ear. Yeah, sure. It's resolution. I mean, usually you think about resolution being a chord tone, but it can be an extension as well. Like you say, especially over minor chords, you know, I like to resolve to a nine, but that third's going to be heard in there somewhere on every chord, no matter, always, you know. But yeah, and the outside stuff too is beautiful. It's just a matter of how you resolve it.
Sure.
You know, it's got to have that tension and release.
How much are you thinking about that as you're doing a solo?
I'd rather not be thinking about any of it. You know, that when in the best circumstances, you're hearing it and not thinking it, you know, and that to me is the ultimate level. But then, yeah, I mean, because at any point I can decide to start intellectualizing, and it might help, but it might hinder, because in that moment, I've already had this thought.
Right.
And is that thought part of the music that's happening now? I don't know. You know, at some point, yes, I'm aware of exactly what's going on, but I'm playing at my best when I don't have to think about it, and it's just happening because the ear is telling me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm hearing in advance what I'd like to hear. I think there's a great clip of, I've mentioned this in some interviews before, but there's a great clip of Bill Evans, being the great jazz pianist, being interviewed by his brother Harry in 1965. It's called The Universal Mind of Bill Evans, and he talks about he's trying to explain improvisation. His brother Harry is actually a jazz educator, so he's the perfect guy to interview Bill. So he's interviewing Bill about his process. He says, yeah, I mean, you know, improvisation is a minute's music in a minute's time, whereas, you know, a composition can take a year to write that minute,
right?
But it's the same thing. I think it's all what we want to hear. You know, when we're writing a song, at least in my mind, we're trying to write something as great as, you know, whatever turned us on, whether it was Beatles or Chopin, whatever it might be, you know, try to rise to that level. Do we ever get there? Probably not. But that's a goalpost. But also, this is the same with soloing. You know, man, I'd love to sound like Lukather and Stern or whoever, you know. It's just my heroes, or Matheny with his sense of melodicism and development. You know, these are all the benchmarks. And then we end up, you know, falling short from that. But that's the beauty, because we end up becoming us.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's such a big part of the whole journey. It's like, well, yeah, I'll never play like Holdsworth, but I can listen to it and love it and just be in awe of it. And maybe some of that will creep in somehow just from the absorption of some of the ideas and some of the feel. But yeah, I'll never play like it, but I don't need to, because he already did it.
So I would guess you're the guy that went to the concert, and you have two choices when you see Holdsworth. You can say, I'm quitting, or I'm going home and practicing. And you must have been the guy who said, I'm going home and practicing.
Yeah, always. In fact, I only got to see Alan play once, and it was maybe the mid-late 80s, and it was with Vinnie Caliuta and Jimmy Johnson. And I forget the keyboard player's name. But anyway, it was, I will say, it was so far over everybody's head. I didn't know where one was all night. You know, I wasn't uneducated at that point, but it was, but no, I mean, he's, you know, is and was capable of playing so much beauty, you know. Yeah, and he could also just go to space and you'd leave everybody behind.
Right.
But no, the one time I went home thinking, oh man, I really suck, was after seeing Vi.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he's another one that's just like, and it was a night where he was really sick. This goes many years back. He was playing a room called the Gypsy Tea Room in Dallas. And usually when he comes through town, we get together. He usually invites me to play, which is obviously very sweet and very humbling. But he said, yeah, man, I'm not feeling very good. You know, so he had a really bad case of the flu.
Hmm.
And so it was an unusual Steve Vai show, because he just stood there all night.
Unusual,
have you ever had to play when you're really sick, Mitch?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No fun.
No, it's no fun, but it's amazing what the body does. Because I had food poisoning once at a clinic in Macon, Georgia, and I played really well.
Hmm.
And that night, I'd never heard Steve play like this. I mean, he's always amazing. But because he, you know, there was no show. He wasn't, you know, as he says, I got a shtick, you know. And, you know, he's not doing some of the Vi-isms and his great showmanship, because all he could do was play. Like, his body was like, I can't do any of that other stuff.
Yeah.
And it was heavy, because, you know, he's in survival mode. And so I think that affects the mind as well. And so all this, I mean, it was just incredible.
Yeah.
But no, and always, you know, because I've had people come up after my kids, man, I'm going to quit playing. I'm going to try. Come on, man, just be inspired. Just, you know, it's, I feel silly when somebody says that after my gig, because if I can do it, anybody can do it. But, you know, just let that be inspiring and just know, you know, because obviously these days we've got, you know, the world of guitar playing in our back pocket all day.
Right.
You click on Instagram and you see these guys playing and girls playing some of the most incredible stuff. And yeah, you can get discouraged and go, well, I'll never be able to do that. But just know that that's possible. And guess what? If you do a little bit of work, folks, you know, if you spend time every day, you might hear yourself sucking a little bit, which is part of it. I hear myself sucking every day. But yeah, you just get that little bit of progress every day. And that, then you start to realize, well, that's it. That's happiness. That's the goal.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I struggled for many years with mental health issues, just over that insecurity and that, oh man, I'll never be like this guy, all my heroes, you know, just, so when you start realizing, but you know, yeah, you're right. But you just be the best you can be. And as long as you're honoring that gift that we have, this beautiful passion for guitar and music, I mean, what better thing could we have in our lives, you know? But make sure it's positive. It can be negative if we let our mind go there and tell ourselves all the negative. We're good at it. We're all good at it. But just embrace the beauty of it too. And just, but if you just get that time in, you know, let that be the spark, you know?
Right. Words of wisdom. I love it.
Well, now that I'm an old guy, yeah, 59, man, we made it. Yeah, pretty good.
So the other part of inspiration and playing and being free to follow the what you hear is tone. And the tones on the new album, of course, all the albums, but especially on the new album, are really beautiful tones.
Thank you, man.
Very, really smooth singing lead tones and nice rhythm tones and things.
Yeah.
And you've got some signature gear
that you use. I do.
And we have to mention that.
That's fine. I'm always happy to talk about gear.
Yeah. Let's talk about your tone and some of these pieces of gear.
Yeah, so the main lead tone for a long time now, ever since I started using the JHS pedal, it started off as... I've been using the Mesa Lone Star for so many years. That's been my main amp, and I was doing a clinic in the UK, but the effects loop wasn't working. That 12AX7, you know, gets worn first, usually the one that drives the effects loop. And so I'm lost without my echo. I got to have my echo. So I was using the amp for lead at the time. So, but you know, if you put a delay in front of your amp that's distorted, it's not usually the best combination, at least that I found. It works for some people. But anyway, so I thought, well, I have to use a gain pedal and then into my delay into a clean amp to achieve a tone. And I had this JHS Angry Charlie on my board as a friend recommended to me. And boy, I had a great gig. Mm-hmm. And my friend Daniel Steinhardt from Gig Rig was there.
Okay.
Anyway, he says, oh, mate, man, your tone was great tonight. What do you play? And I noticed that, so, you know, it's a different response when you're using the amp for your gain, you know, it's a certain weight that you're pulling. But I was noticing, at least with this particular combination of this pedal, this power section, I had EL34s in the power section of the Lone Star, I had more of an immediacy. And so I thought I had a little bit more control over the detail. So I started using that pedal. And maybe a year or two goes by, and I was at a NAMM show, and I thought, I should go meet Josh at, you know, JHS. We hadn't met yet. So I went by to say hi to Josh and say, hey, man, I'm using your pedal. He goes, man, I'm glad you came here, because we've had the Angry Charlie out for a long time, but then all of a sudden we started selling all these pedals. I guess people were seeing it on my pedal board, and that's a humbling, honoring thing to hear. But so I said, well, if there's anything I'd like to change about it, maybe we could do a signature version, you know, or do a customized version. And there was some things that I thought would be better for me, at least selfishly for me. So he was happy to go down that path, and that's what became my AT pedal, the AT sign.
Right.
Some people call it the AT pedal, and I guess that's accurate, but I really intended it to be called the AT. It is an AT sign.
Right.
Well, he says, like, oh, we don't like, put the name of the pedal on it. We just do some kind of, like, clever, you know, logo or insignia. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, the AT, A-T, that makes... Anyway, the joke is lost on some. But so that's my main... If I'm on my humbucker for a bolder lead tone, that's what you're hearing, is that pedal into the front of a clean amp. And at that, for those sessions, it was all Lone Star. I had two rental Lone Star combos and two rectifier 212s for the sessions, because that's what I used at home. Mm-hmm. And then when I did the overdubs at my home studio, it was the same signal path. I might have used an occasional vintage Fender for a particular part, or maybe a clean, but in general, that was the basic signal path. And but at that time, so now I do have a signature delay.
Yes, you do.
It's a dual echo that I worked for about 3 years. It was in the process of being worked on when we did Electric Truth. But that what you're hearing is the old timeline that I was using at the time. But basically, what I wanted with a signature delay pedal, and this started with actually Daniel Steinhardt again. I got to bring up my friend Daniel again, because I was like, look, the timeline's cool. And what I was doing with the timeline was trying to replicate my two vintage Electro Harmonics Memory Man echoes, because I was running them in series, like one set at like a quarter note, one set at like a dotted eighth. And the timeline did, I worked really hard, deep, you know, editing, getting the timeline to do a good job of it. And that timeline being a much more robust, dependable unit, but it does 1,000 things. I'm using one sound. Right. can I just get my sound in a pedal? And so I went to Daniel and said, who should I ask to collaborate? He says, Robert Keeley, without blinking. He said, Robert Keeley's your guy. And so he walked me right over to Robert's booth at NAMM. We spoke about it, and he was really excited about the idea. And they were just working on a new platform that was going to become their pedal called Echos, ECCOS. Yep. And so, look, once we get this done, then we'll start working on your pedal. But then all kind of thing happened. The pandemic happened, health issues with Robert. But anyway, once we finally got on it, about a year and a half of back and forth working on taking from my experience with the timeline, the Electro Harmonics, you know, Bucket Brigade thing, and the EP3 tape echoes that I would use a lot too in the studio. Just things that I loved about all these things. How can I get that into this one ultimate tone? And then they knew that, like, look, it's not going to go on the board until we improve and make it better than all the other things that I was using. And man, when we got there, I couldn't believe it. And it truly is, man. I'm like, I know this sounds like a crummy commercial, like Ralphie on The Christmas Story, but they knocked it out of the park. But it was, we worked hard. I mean, we never would settle, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was like, so they're in Oklahoma City, and I'm in a northern Dallas suburb called McKinney. We're 3 hours apart. So that was the key. I've collaborated with companies on gear before, but not always in the same room. You know, you can go, oh yeah, this is cool, but could you tweak this? Yeah, okay. But when you're in the room and really feeling the same thing, that's when you can really fine tune. And so it was Robert would come down personally, and also his right-hand man, Aaron Pierce, who has ears very in tune with mine. Mm-hmm. So that was another thing. It's like, so, you know, and Robert's a freaking brilliant, you know, he can play, and he's a great, you know, technical guy, but he has ears too, obviously, but with, between the three of us, we got it there. And so now I've got this, you know, in a regular size pedal enclosure, but they also, you know, said, well, you know, we can do other sounds. I'm like, well, all right. So we came up with some other, you know, multi-tap things. One to replicate the Hank Marvin multi-tap on Apache, mm-hmm, from the old Miazzi tape echoes, and one that's more like the Tom Scholl's 300-500, which is not like 375-500, which is more like the dotted eighth quarter. So, but it can do a simple quarter tap or dotted eighth. It's got tap tempo on it. It's got just a beautiful modulation. And I set it up for a slap every now and then too. That's usually my go-to second echo. Because I use that, and we call it the halo, because I always envisioned when I would get my delays set just right, those two echoes and the way they would kind of dissolve into each other. It just kind of becomes this halo around the note. It's almost like a reverb, because a lot of people think I'm using a lot of reverb along with delay, but it's all the delay. So that's the main tone of it. But you can have like 8 different sounds programmed into it.
One of the things that about that though is the way you almost play the delay using an expression pedal. As you're working through the different parts of a song, yes, and different tones.
Yeah, so you can hook up an expression pedal to it, and it can control any parameter from the time to the modulation, or, you know, all the you know, deep editing. You can control any of that, but I've only got it set for the mix, because it's basically it's just never off. It's just like, how much do I need, you know, and to, you know, when I want to let it breathe a bit more, it stays out of the way, even if I have a heavy amount of effect. It never gets in the way. It's not too literal with the repeats. It's really tape-like in that way. That's the beauty of the EP3s, was like, just where that first repeat sits and then how the other ones are just so out of the way. That's part of the beauty of trying to really dial it in properly. So, but yeah, just purely for the mix, I'll have, you know, heel down on dry, and then obscenely wet on toe, and I'm usually closer to obscenely wet. That's just me. I'm like Madge soaking in the Palmolive. You know,
that's awesome.
That's an old guy joke.
Right? Yeah, right. I like
Sorry, Madge, you're soaking in it. Yes, that's right. Relax. It's Halo.
Yes, exactly. So I have one more thing I have to ask you about.
Sure, sure.
And this goes back to, I guess it would be the 80s, and a crossroads in your career.
Yeah.
Is it true that you had at the same time had basically an offer from Tower of Power and from Danger Danger?
That's pretty crazy.
How would you navigate that decision?
Life is all about your decisions, Mitch, right? Well, okay, so yeah, I'd sent the guys in Danger Danger tape. Let me try to tell the story the best way I can succinctly. Buddy Blaze, the now recently departed, good dear friend of mine, Buddy Blaze, was artist relations for Kramer Guitars. And Ricky Phillips was part of a band called The Babies with John Wade back in the day, but they were forming a new supergroup called Bad English. Yep. Neil Sean was originally going to do the band, did the demos, but bowed out at a certain point because he had a solo deal in Columbia. So it was Jonathan Cain, John Wade, and Ricky Phillips. They needed a guitar player. Ricky was playing Spectre basses, which was Kramer. He went to Buddy and said, we need a bluesy but rock, you know, guy. And Buddy thought, well, Texas, where Buddy was from, he was from Arlington, because he was a big part of Dime's early career. Mm-hmm. He built that, yep. You know, all those guitars and Vivian Campbell stuff. Anyway, so he reached out to a journalist friend of his in Dallas, and I was kind of the guy happening at the time. Andy Timmons' band had just formed, and we were starting to play around town, where I was like, somebody called me the poor man's Eric Johnson in one of my reviews. I'm like, I'll take that. Yeah, right. I'll take that any day. that tape got into their hands, and I auditioned for Bad English, and I got the gig. I went out and flew in and played. And then they were going to fly me out again to start rehearsals, and they said, oh, Andy, we've had a call from Neil, and he's interested in doing the gig again. We'll let you know how it goes. We'll call you. And never got the call.
Yeah, right.
But right about that time, Buddy was saying, like, look, there's this other band, Danger Danger, looking for a guitar player. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, thinking like, oh, I'm a kicked puppy at this point. But then also at that same time, Steve Grove, who was a tenor player who I'd gone to Miami with, was on the road with Tower of Power. And they were coming through Dallas. He said, look, our guitar player, Danny Jacobs, is leaving to do the Laura Branigan tour, mm-hmm. and we need a guitar player. Come sit in, you know, learn Squib Cakes and What Is Hip. I'm like, great. Are you kidding me? So I went and went to the record store, bought these records and learned them and went down and sat in, and it went amazing. It was a great night, you know, got to play. And I believe it was Emilio, the band leader, that said, look, you know, we'd like to have you come out and work with us. But I had just also gotten that offer, and I'd already auditioned for Danger Danger. So that's, but you know, it's kind of like either one, you know.
Can't lose, right?
Well, it would have been interesting, because I just think the allure of a band that was headed towards MTV, you know, for the rock guy in me, that was attractive. But you know, when I think about the jazz fusion guy, because at that time I would have loved to have gotten a call from Miles, you know, because I was, sure. You know, poor man's Mike Stern or Mike Stern wannabe, you know, because those guys were such heroes. So it's just one of those things, you never know where things could have gone. I don't know. I mean, I think what Danger Danger afforded me was a massive education in music business 101. What it was, it helped me find out who I was, what I really wanted out of a music career. But it also did put me on the world stage. We toured with opening for Kiss on two different tours, my childhood heroes. You know, I couldn't have, never in a million years would I think that was possible.
Right.
You know, because my mind as a kid, being in a band like that was like winning the lottery. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why I went down the path of, and I had a band that was doing really well in that part of the country. You know, we were local heroes, I should say, but we were making records and we could have got signed. I was sending tapes to all the record labels and getting responses like, yeah, you keep in touch. You know, this sounds good. But, you know, finding other people that are as driven as you are, you know, is the hard thing. So that's when I ended up going to Miami and going down the path of just the journeyman, you know, just wherever I could go for a gig. So, you know, musically, maybe Danger Danger wasn't 1,000% what I really wanted to do at the time, but I enjoyed the heck out of it. I'm a great team player. You know, mm-hmm. I think I served the band well, and we had a great, great time. I love the guys dearly. But after that, I was very happy to come back to Texas and really do the music that was purely in my heart. I realized, okay, this is cool. And I enjoyed being that team player, but I just want to, after witnessing the machinations of the music business as it was at the time, it's like, this is just a huge corporate thing. And the musician has zero to do with, you know, the bottom line, right? And I kind of just saw that from my view, the position I was in. I was like, okay, this is not the Holy Grail I thought it was.
Yeah.
Because you think growing up as kids, being in that major label band, that's it. What else is there? And again, I'm not dogging it. I'm saying I had the childhood fantasy in some ways, but what I really wanted to do was just keep working at my craft and being a guitar player. So I went back to Texas and ended up putting out my first solo record called Ear Ecstasy, mm-hmm. which I'd been recording during the Danger years already with my band. When we'd be off tour, I'd go home and record, thinking I was making demos. And Reb Beach got a hold of my demo cassette one day and said, Andy, what are you talking about? Your record's done. This is it. And I realized that he was right. So even though I thought they were demos, but because I did, it was just done in such a way that I could have never replicated. That's why there's actually a couple of tracks on that first record that are like Zoom. Remember the old Zoom 9002?
Yeah.
Not the best sounding guitar processor, but at the time, you know, it was a good handy. So I would just do a scratch track and just blow something down, you know.
Like, yeah.
But then how are you going to top that vibe, you know? So back then, it was kind of performance over tone. It's like, I just want the vibe and I want the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want it all. I'm trying to get all that.
Rightfully so.
And I love, tone does matter, kids, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. Boy, we're going to have a conversation.
You recently remastered that album, correct?
Okay, basically unmastered. I'm glad you brought that up because we, you know, back then it was like, you know, we had the record finished and it was all done on 2-inch, 24 track. Back in the old days, folks. But then we just sent it off to Nashville. Because that's what you did. Send it off to be mastered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we got it back. Okay, that's what we get. But it was really kind of hyped in the high end and almost sounded like they'd put it through like a what was the old BBE unit? The Sonic Maximum. Oh, yeah, it wasn't quite that bad. But it's like, I'd found the original DAT, the unmastered DAT that we compiled to send. And I went, oh my God, this sounds so much better. Mm. There's that analog fat tape sound. So we took those original mixes and just did a good balancing and a little bit of help here and there if we needed to, because some of the tracks were recorded over from 88 to 94. So, you know, some sonic differences. And yeah, I think it improved the record a lot. So it's amazing. You know, I was like, oh man, you do all this work and then here you go, random guy that I'm not in a room with. Do what you, but we didn't know. We were just trying to get something, get a record out there. So yeah, very happily found those tapes. Like, wow, I like this a lot better.
Fun to revisit.
Yeah, it's, what's that?
Fun to revisit.
It is. Yeah, it's sometimes humbling, sometimes mortifying. You know, but no. There. In fact, I've been doing all these live stream that started at the beginning of the pandemic. Figured out ways of doing, you know, live stream concert sessions from my home studio. And a lot of times, you know, every time I've done mixes for my records over the years, I always do one without the guitar, so I can do guitar clinics and master classes. Mm-hmm. But it served me well for the streaming gigs, because it's like I'm doing a clinic. I've just got my backing track and I know how to make that work and have it feel good, right? So, but somebody requested the very first tune that I ever recorded with my trio. It's called It's Getting Better. Just it's kind of Jeff Beck shuffly kind of tune. But I don't have, because it was such an early track, I didn't have a backing track for it. So I had to go back. To be able to play it, I had to play identically what's on the track. I had to be my 1988, 25-year-old self. And it was interesting because some of the stuff I still do, but a lot of the stuff I don't. So I had to kind of get in the headspace of where I was then. And there was just things that I would never have thought to do that now, but well, that's cool. Yeah. So sometimes you go back and you can go, okay, I need to learn from younger me. Because like everything, your taste change and your playing path, you know. Unless you're still practicing the exact things you played, which I don't. So, but there's a lot of, you know, I'm learning. I also say that in when I'm learning these tunes for some of these tunes for the guitar experience, yeah, I recognize elements that I would have improvised. That man, I should work on that because that's a cool idea and that could be extrapolated in so many ways.
Right.
So and that's the beauty of any transcription, whether it's your own body of work or. You don't have to transcribe the whole Holdsworth or West solo, but man, get that one nugget and then see where you can take that, mm-hmm. you know? Because sometimes if you look at, you know, I'm going to transcribe Coltrane's Giant Steps, it's going to take a minute, which may be fun for some. That was never fun for me, but I did it in school where we had to handwrite everything out. But I'm just as good and even better served with the smaller chunks. Not just beware of the overwhelm. Take that little bit to give you that nugget of, oh, wow, I've got something new.
Right.
That's so important. And that's part of that daily. If you could do that, ideally to do that every day would be my prescription for myself and for everybody. Just that one little idea to take you out of whatever rut you're in, you know, because we tend to have this body of stuff that we always draw from, and that's beautiful. You know, I always reference, you know, Stevie Ray. There wasn't, you know, a depth of particular theoretical knowledge. He didn't need that. He had this, you know, great palette of, you know, blues and Hendrix, but he could just play it in the moment better than anybody.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't need to know all the substitutions and be overwhelmed with all the knowledge. Don't get weighed down with that. It's cool to learn if you're at that place and you want that little extra, that's great. But man, it's all the foundational stuff. And if you just take, you know, one little idea at a time and add that to what you do, boy, it can just change so much.
I always think of it as, of course, we all use the word vocabulary when we're talking about, you know, those kind of things. But the point to vocabulary with spoken word is putting the sentences together in your own way and conveying your thoughts.
That's a great.
And it's very much the same thing when you're working on musical ideas and the musical vocabulary you have.
Exactly. And to speak to that just slightly, that was one of the things I made a conscious decision about when playing jazz, because there is a not a set vocabulary, but there's a guitar and jazz vocabulary that you can learn these licks and these lines and string them together. And Joe Pass, I think, was kind of one of these guys. You can kind of hear there's a lot of ideas that got used a lot in the moment. And there was a great jazz trumpet player named Chet Baker, who I never heard do that. He always seemed like he was in the moment and playing melodically. And I thought, I could be a guy trying to learn that vocabulary,
right?
But I'll never be Clint Strong, you know. Well, so one of these guys that just could just play all these lines, and it's just you recognize them, and it's beautiful, and I love them, and I've learned some of them, and I do like to play them. Some Charlie Parker stuff that I use quite a bit to this day. But what I heard Chet doing was where I wanted to be, where I didn't hear repetition of particular licks, but it was always in the moment, and it was always really touching emotionally. And I really studied his life. It's a pretty tragic life because he was a lifelong junkie. But
he was also a vocalist.
He was also, indeed.
That conveyed over, I think, to the way he phrased and the way he thought about melody on trumpet.
Very much so. And the thing is that he didn't know, he couldn't tell you what the harmony was.
Yeah.
He couldn't have told you the changes to the tune. He heard them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing. But yeah, but it's also he had lost a tooth in his late teens. So most people didn't know that he was, all that early stuff, he was playing with it. And then he had a brutal beating in the late 60s, probably, rumored to be over a drug deal gone bad. They knocked his front teeth out completely. So the rest of his career, he's playing with dentures, which should be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But it also explains why I love his playing so much, because he couldn't scream at me. I'm not a big jazz trumpet guy. You know, I mean, Dizzy and Maynard and all these guys, they're great. But sometimes all that high pitch, you know, it's not my favorite thing. But Chet's tone was so beautiful, basically because he couldn't, with his embouchure, he couldn't hit the high notes. So his limitations is why I loved him so much. And you're right, that's a great point, Mitch, that he's a singer. But again, I know there'll be certain bits of phrases that are things that I've said before. But the real beauty can happen when you're just connecting melodically and not having to, you know, think about, oh, I've got this lick, then I'm going to play this lick. And you can navigate and you can make some great music that way. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But for me personally, the goal that in my journey was more like Chet. Have it be something that maybe I haven't said before. You know, especially, even if it's something I said before, I want it to be fresh in that moment. Like you say, you can imbue, even if I'm playing something that I've composed, like there's some tunes like off my Resolution record where that was the first record I ever did where I literally composed every note on the record. I gave myself permission to write the solos. And I'd never done that before. It was painful because it was really hard. But when I got done with it, once I finally achieved it, man, was I happy with it, because it was truly my melodic sense, you know, taking the time to do it. And I wouldn't have been good enough to improvise it, you know, but then I was able to compose it. So now when I play those particular tunes, because that time was put into it, I tend to play them as composed, but in the moment of replaying them, I'm going to try to make it feel like it's the first time you ever heard it.
You interpret it.
You know, and I will, you know, say humbly that I've gotten pretty good at that. And maybe I've just always kind of been good at that energy of the moment thing. I don't know. That's something develops over time, I suppose. But anyway, those are my goals, whether I achieve them every day or not. That's another story, but.
Right.
Yeah. But that vocabulary thing, that's an interesting word, but that's also why I wrote that tune, When Words Fail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very specifically about the written language and spoken language versus instrumental music, because we're not constrained to the verbal, meaning. You know, the listener can take the music however they need to take it.
Right.
You know what I mean? When words fail, it's like, well, words usually do. You know, some people communicate better than others. So, right. You know what I mean? But even the ones that communicate well, it's how is it interpreted by the listener? You know, they might take it the wrong way. Maybe the tone was a little more terse than intended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the thing I've always loved about instrumental music, that I think it can go a bit deeper
mm-hmm.
than your verbally communicative ideas, you know.
Right. Oh, so yeah. Much good stuff.
I don't know. Well, it's just the coffee talking, folks. Yeah.
Sweetwater Coffee. The new album is Electric Truth, and I highly recommend checking it out because it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Man, we're excited about the masterclass tonight.
Yeah.
I'm going to sneak in and poke my head through the door.
Yeah,
anyway,
please
and
do.
See if I can pick up a nugget and take home.
Throw stuff at me, man. Yeah, you know? Stump the guitar player. You know?
Then the workshop this weekend.
Yeah, we're doing some recording.
Mm-hmm, that's going
to
be cool.
So I've been coming to this. I don't know how many trips I've been to Sweetwater, but I've always drooled over the recording facilities.
Right.
I mean, just the massive facility that Sweetwater is in the first place. You know, the great, outdoor concert facility and the studio. So, yeah, look very much forward to playing with some of the staff here. Nick and Dave are going to be the rhythm section. I'll put great a couple players. Tunes together. And yeah, we'll see what happens. We're going to have a good time, man.
That's going to be fun. Well, man, thanks so much for sitting down with us
today.
Man.
I appreciate you, man. Good
first
chat.
Thing in the morning.
Yeah, that's all right. I've got my guitar and my coffee.
There you go.
This is what I do,
Right on, man. It's great to see you.
Great to see you, man.
And, keep up the great work, because it's just so inspiring to watch everything that you're doing.
Thank you, buddy. It means a lot.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope that you enjoyed this installment of the Plugged In Podcast by Sweetwater. Special thanks to Andy Timmons for taking time out of his busy schedule to sit down with us for this interview. It was a real pleasure to have him here on the podcast. And thanks to Andy for sharing some music from his new album, Electric Truth. You heard excerpts from EWF during the interview, and right now you're hearing When Words Fail. In case you're wondering, the intro and outro for Plugged In were recorded using an Audio-Technica BP-40 large diaphragm dynamic broadcast microphone, and it was run into a brand new Avid MBox Studio audio interface and then into Avid Pro Tools. My interview with Andy was all Universal Audio. We used a pair of SD-1 large diaphragm dynamic microphones connected to an Apollo X4 audio interface and recorded into Luna. I monitored on Shure SRH-1540 headphones, while Andy listened on Rode's new NTH-100 headphones. By the way, I did all the recording for this podcast on a MacBook Pro running a beta version of macOS 13 Ventura. It's always a little scary using a beta OS with software that's not been qualified by the manufacturers yet, but I took the chance to test how well Ventura's working. I don't recommend taking a chance like that, but hey, I'm living on the edge, so you don't have to. I edited and mixed this podcast using Presonus Studio One 6 with FabFilter, Waves, and SSL plugins. I listened on PMC Result 6 monitors, and I kept an eye on everything using the Process Audio Decibel Metering plugin. Thanks for joining us for Plugged In by Sweetwater. Remember to start at sweetwater.com for all your music instrument and pro audio needs. I'm Mitch Gallagher, and this has been the Plugged In Podcast by Sweetwater.